Chapter 101. The Swiss consulate in Istanbul is located at 1 Levant Plaza in a sleek, ultra-modern skyscraper. The building's concave blue glass facade resembles a futuristic monolith along the skyline of the ancient metropolis. Nearly an hour had passed since Sinsky had left the cistern to set up a temporary command post in the consulate offices. The local news stations hummed with reports of the panicked stampede at the cistern's final performance of Liszt's Dante's Symphony. No specifics had been reported yet, but the presence of an international medical team wearing hazmat suits had sparked wild speculation. Sinsky stared out the window at the lights of the city and felt utterly alone. Reflexively, she reached to her neck for her amulet necklace, but there was nothing to grasp. The broken talisman now lay on her desk in two fractured halves. The WHO director had just finished coordinating an array of emergency meetings to be held in Geneva in several hours. Specialists from various agencies were already en route, and Sinsky herself planned to fly there shortly to brief them. Mercifully, someone on the night staff had delivered a piping hot mug of authentic Turkish coffee, which Sinsky had quickly drained. A young man on the consulate staff peered in her open door. "Ma'am, Robert Langdon is here to see you."
"Thank you," she replied. "You can send him in."
20 minutes earlier, Langdon had contacted Sinsky by phone and explained that Sienna Brooks had eluded him, having stolen a boat and fled out to sea. Sinsky had already heard this news from the authorities, who were still searching the area, but so far had come up empty-handed. Now, as Langdon's tall frame materialized in the doorway, she barely recognized him. His suit was dirty, his dark hair tousled, and his eyes looked weary and sunken.
"Professor, are you okay?"
Sinsky stood up. Langdon gave her a tired smile. "I've had easier nights."
"Please," she said, motioning to a chair. "Have a seat."
"Zobrist's contagion," Langdon began without preamble as he sat down. "I think it may have been released a week ago." Sinsky gave a patient nod.
"Yes, we've come to the same conclusion. No symptoms have been reported yet, but we've isolated samples and are already gearing up for intensive testing. Unfortunately, it could take days or weeks to get a real grip on what this virus is and what it might do."
"It's a vector virus," Langdon said. Sinsky cocked her head in surprise, startled to hear that he even knew the term.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Zobrist created an airborne vector virus capable of modifying human DNA." Sinsky rose abruptly, knocking her chair over in the process.
"That's not even possible. What would ever make you claim such a thing?"
"Sienna," Langdon replied quietly. "She told me. Half an hour ago." Sinsky leaned her hands on her desk and stared across at Langdon with sudden distrust.
"She didn't escape?"
"She certainly did," he replied. "She was free in a boat speeding out to sea, and she easily could have disappeared forever. But she thought better of it. She came back of her own volition. Sienna wants to help with this crisis." A harsh laugh escaped Sinsky's lips.
"Forgive me if I'm not inclined to trust Ms. Brooks, especially when she's making such a far-fetched claim."
"I believe her," Langdon said, his tone unwavering. "And if she claims that this is a vector virus, I think you'd better take her seriously." Sinsky suddenly felt exhausted, her mind struggling to analyze Langdon's words. She moved to the window and stared out.
"A DNA-altering viral vector?"
As improbable and horrifying as the prospect sounded, she had to admit there was an eerie logic to it. After all, Zobrist was a genetic engineer and knew firsthand that the smallest mutation in a single gene could have catastrophic effects on the body, cancers, organ failure, and blood disorders, even a disease as abhorrent as cystic fibrosis, which drowns its victim in mucus, was caused by nothing more than a minuscule hiccup in a regulator gene on chromosome 7. Specialists had now started treating these genetic conditions with rudimentary vector viruses that were injected directly into the patient. These non-contagious viruses were programmed to travel through the patient's body and install replacement DNA that fixed the damaged sections. This new science, however, like all sciences, had a dark side. The effects of a vector virus could be either favorable or destructive, depending on the engineer's intentions. If a virus were maliciously programmed to insert damaged DNA into healthy cells, the results would be devastating. Moreover, if that destructive virus were somehow engineered to be highly contagious and airborne, the prospect made Sinsky shudder.
What genetic horror has Zobrist dreamed up? How does he plan to thin the human herd?
Sinsky knew that finding the answer could take weeks. The human genetic code contained a seemingly infinite labyrinth of chemical permutations. The prospect of searching its entirety in hopes of finding Zobrist's one specific alteration would be like looking for a needle in a haystack, without even knowing on what planet that particular haystack was located. Elizabeth? Langdon's deep voice pulled her back. Sinsky turned from the window and looked at him. Did you hear me? He asked, still seated calmly. Sienna wanted to destroy this virus as much as you did.
I sincerely doubt that.
Langdon exhaled, standing now. I think you should listen to me. Shortly before his death, Zobrist wrote a letter to Sienna telling her what he had done. He outlined exactly what this virus would do, how it would attack us, how it would achieve his goals. Sinsky froze.
There's a letter?
When Sienna read Zobrist's description of what he had created, she was horrified. She wanted to stop him. She considered his virus so dangerous that she didn't want anybody to gain access to it, including the World Health Organization. Don't you see? Sienna has been trying to destroy the virus, not release it.
There's a letter?
Sinsky demanded, her focus now singular.
With specifics?
That's what Sienna told me, yes.
We need that letter. Having specifics could save us months in understanding what this thing is and knowing how to handle it.
Langdon shook his head. You don't understand. When Sienna read Zobrist's letter, she was terrified. She burned it immediately. She wanted to be sure nobody... Sinsky smacked her hand down on the desk.
She destroyed the one thing that could help us prepare for this crisis, and you want me to trust her?
I know it's asking a lot, in light of her actions. But rather than castigating her, it might be helpful to remember that Sienna has a unique intellect, including a rather startling capacity for recall. Langdon paused. What if she can recreate enough of Zobrist's letter to be helpful to you? Sinsky narrowed her gaze, nodding slightly.
Well, Professor, in that case, what do you suggest I do?
Langdon motioned to her empty coffee cup. I suggest you order more coffee and listen to the one condition that Sienna has requested. Sinsky's pulse quickened, and she glanced at the phone.
You know how to reach her?
I do.
Tell me what she requested.
Langdon told her, and Sinsky fell silent, considering the proposal. I think it's the right thing to do, Langdon added. And what do you have to lose?
If everything you're saying is true, then you have my word.
Sinsky pushed the phone toward him.
Please make the call.
To Sinsky's surprise, Langdon ignored the phone. Instead, he stood up and headed out the door, stating that he would be back in a minute. Puzzled, Sinsky walked into the hall and observed him striding through the consulate's waiting area, pushing open the glass doors, and exiting into the elevator foyer beyond. For a moment, she thought he was leaving, but then, rather than summoning the elevator, he slipped quietly into the women's restroom. A few moments later, he emerged with a woman who looked to be in her early 30s. Sinsky needed a long moment to accept the fact that this was truly Sienna Brooks. The pretty ponytailed woman she had seen earlier in the day had been utterly transformed. She was totally bald, as if her scalp had been shaved clean. When the two entered her office, they silently took seats facing the desk.
Forgive me, Sienna said quickly. I know we have a lot to discuss. But first, I was hoping you would permit me to say something that I really need to say.
Sinsky noted the sadness in Sienna's voice.
Of course. Ma'am,
she began, her voice frail,
you are the director of the World Health Organization. You know better than anyone that we are a species on the edge of collapse, a population out of control. For years, Bertrand Zobrist attempted to engage with influential people like yourself to discuss the impending crisis. He visited countless organizations that he believed could effect change. World Watch Institute, the Club of Rome, Population Matters, the Council on Foreign Relations. But he never found anyone who dared engage in a meaningful conversation about a real solution. You all responded with plans for better contraceptive education, tax incentives for smaller families, and even talk of colonizing the moon. It's no wonder Bertrand lost his mind.
Sinsky stared at her, offering no reaction. Sienna took a deep breath.
Dr. Sinsky, Bertrand came to you personally. He begged you to acknowledge that we are on the brink, begged you to engage in some kind of dialogue. But rather than listening to his ideas, you called him a madman, put him on a watch list, and drove him underground.
Sienna's voice grew heavy with emotion.
Bertrand died all alone because people like yourself refused to open your minds enough even to admit that our catastrophic circumstances might actually require an uncomfortable solution. All Bertrand ever did was speak the truth. And for that, he was ostracized.
Sienna wiped her eyes and gazed across the desk at Sinsky.
Believe me, I know what it's like to feel all alone. The worst kind of loneliness in the world is the isolation that comes from being misunderstood. It can make people lose their grasp on reality.
Sienna stopped talking, and a strained silence followed.
That's all I wanted to say, she whispered.
Sinsky studied her for a long while, and then sat down.
Miss Brooks, she said as calmly as possible, you're right. I may not have listened before.
She folded her hands on the desk and looked directly at Sienna.
But I'm listening now.
Chapter 102. The clock in the Swiss consulate's lobby had long since chimed 1 a.m. The notepad on Sinsky's desk was now a patchwork of handwritten text, questions, and diagrams. The director of the World Health Organization had neither moved nor spoken in more than 5 minutes. She stood at the window, staring out into the night. Behind her, Langdon and Sienna waited, seated in silence, cradling the last of their Turkish coffee, the heavy aroma of its pulverized grounds and pistachio grains filling the room. The only sound was the buzz of the fluorescent lights overhead. Sienna could feel her own heart pounding, and she wondered what Sinsky was thinking. Having now heard the truth in brutal detail,
Bertrand's virus is a sterility plague. 1/3 of the human population will be infertile.
Throughout the explanation, Sienna had watched Sinsky's range of emotions, which, while restrained, had been palpable. First, there was a stunned acceptance of the fact that Zobrist had actually created an airborne vector virus. Next, she had displayed fleeting hope when she learned that the virus was not designed to kill people. Then, slowly, there had been the spiraling horror as the truth set in, and she realized that vast portions of the Earth's population would be rendered sterile. It was clear that the revelation that the virus attacked human fertility affected Sinsky on a deeply personal level. In Sienna's case, the overwhelming emotion was relief. She had shared the complete contents of Bertrand's letter with the WHO director.
I have no more secrets.
Elizabeth? Langdon ventured. Sinsky emerged slowly from her thoughts. When she returned her gaze to them, her face was drawn.
Sienna,
she began, speaking in a flat tone,
the information you have provided will be very helpful in preparing a strategy to deal with this crisis. I appreciate your candor. As you know, pandemic vector viruses have been discussed theoretically as a possible way to immunize large populations. But everyone believed that the technology was still many years away.
Sinsky returned to her desk, where she sat down.
Forgive me, she said, shaking her head. This all feels like science fiction to me at the moment.
Not surprising, Sienna thought. Every quantum leap in medicine had always felt this way. Penicillin, anesthesia, X-rays. The first time humans looked through a microscope and saw a cell divide. Dr. Sinsky gazed down at her notepad.
In a few hours, I will arrive in Geneva to a firestorm of questions. I have no doubt that the first question will be whether there is any way to counteract this virus.
Sienna suspected she was right.
And, Sinsky continued, I imagine the first proposed solution will be to analyze Bertrand's virus, understand it as best we can, and then attempt to engineer a second strain of it, a strain that we reprogram in order to change our DNA back to its original form.
Sinsky did not look optimistic as she turned her gaze to Sienna.
Whether a countervirus is even possible remains to be seen. But hypothetically speaking, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that approach.
My thoughts? Sienna felt herself glance reflexively at Langdon. The professor gave her a nod, sending a very clear message. You've come this far. Speak your mind. Tell the truth as you see it. Sienna cleared her throat, turned to Sinsky, and spoke in a clear, strong voice.
Ma'am, the world of genetic engineering is one I've inhabited with Bertrand for many years. As you know, the human genome is an extremely delicate structure, a house of cards. The more adjustments we make, the greater the chances we mistakenly alter the wrong card and bring the entire thing crashing down. My personal belief is that there is enormous danger in attempting to undo what has already been done. Bertrand was a genetic engineer of exceptional skill and vision. He was years ahead of his peers. At this point in time, I'm not sure I would trust anyone else to go poking around in the human genome, hoping to get it right. Even if you designed something you thought might work, trying it would involve reinfecting the entire population with something new.
Very true, Sinsky said, seeming unsurprised by what she had just heard.
But, of course, there is the bigger issue. We might not even want to counteract it.
Her words caught Sienna off guard.
I'm sorry? Ms. Brooks, I may disagree with Bertrand's methods, but his assessment of the state of the world is accurate. This planet is facing a serious overpopulation issue. If we manage to neutralize Bertrand's virus without a viable alternate plan, we are simply back at square one.
Sienna's shock must have been apparent, because Sinsky gave her a tired chuckle and added,
Not a viewpoint you expected to hear from me?
Sienna shook her head.
I guess I'm not sure what to expect anymore. Then perhaps I can surprise you again.
Sinsky went on.
As I mentioned earlier, leaders from top health agencies around the world will be gathering in Geneva in a matter of hours to discuss this crisis and prepare an action plan. I can't recall a gathering of greater significance in all my years at the WHO.
She leveled her gaze at the young doctor.
Sienna, I would like you to have a seat at that table.
Me? Sienna recoiled. I'm not a genetic engineer. I've told you everything I know. She pointed to Sinsky's notepad.
Everything I have to offer is right there in your notes.
Not by a long shot, Langdon interjected. Sienna, any meaningful debate about this virus will require context. Dr. Sinsky and her team will need to develop a moral framework to assess their response to this crisis. She obviously believes you are in a unique position to add to that dialogue.
My moral framework, I suspect, will not please the WHO.
Probably not, Langdon replied, which is all the more reason for you to be there. You are a member of a new breed of thinkers. You provide counterpoint. You can help them understand the mindset of visionaries like Bertrand, brilliant individuals whose convictions are so strong that they take matters into their own hands.
Bertrand was hardly the first.
No, Sinsky interjected,
and he won't be the last. Every month, the WHO uncovers labs where scientists are dabbling in the gray areas of science. Everything from manipulating human stem cells to breeding chimeras, blended species that don't exist in nature. It's disturbing. Science is progressing so fast that nobody knows where the lines are drawn anymore.
Sienna had to agree. Just recently, two very respected virologists, Fouchier and Kawaoka, had created a highly pathogenic mutant H5N1 virus. Despite the researchers' purely academic intent, their new creation possessed certain capabilities that had alarmed biosecurity specialists and had created a firestorm of controversy online.
"I'm afraid it's only going to get murkier," Sinsky said. "We're on the verge of new technologies that we can't yet even imagine."
"And new philosophies as well," Sienna added. "The transhumanist movement is about to explode from the shadows into the mainstream. One of its fundamental tenets is that we as humans have a moral obligation to participate in our evolutionary process, to use our technologies to advance the species, to create better humans, healthier, stronger, with higher functioning brains. Everything will soon be possible."
"And you don't think that such beliefs are in conflict with the evolutionary process?"
"No," Sienna responded without hesitation. "Humans have evolved incrementally over millennia, inventing new technologies along the way, rubbing sticks together for warmth, developing agriculture to feed ourselves, inventing vaccines to fight disease, and now, creating genetic tools to help engineer our own bodies so we can survive in a changing world." She paused. "I believe genetic engineering is just another step in a long line of human advances."
Sinsky was silent, deep in thought.
"So you believe we should embrace these tools with open arms?"
"If we don't embrace them," Sienna replied, "then we are as undeserving of life as the caveman who freezes to death because he's afraid to start a fire."
Her words seemed to hang in the room for a long time before anyone spoke. It was Langdon who broke the silence. "Not to sound old-fashioned," he began, "but I was raised on the theories of Darwin, and I can't help but question the wisdom of attempting to accelerate the natural process of evolution."
"Robert," Sienna said emphatically, "genetic engineering is not an acceleration of the evolutionary process. It is the natural course of events. What you forget is that it was evolution that created Bertrand Zobrist. His superior intellect was the product of the very process Darwin described, an evolution over time. Bertrand's rare insight into genetics did not come as a flash of divine inspiration. It was the product of years of human intellectual progress."
Langdon fell silent, apparently considering the notion.
"And as a Darwinist," she continued, "you know that nature has always found a way to keep the human population in check. Plagues, famines, floods. But let me ask you this. Isn't it possible that nature found a different way this time? Instead of sending us horrific disasters and misery, maybe nature, through the process of evolution, created a scientist who invented a different method of decreasing our numbers over time. No plagues, no death, just a species more in tune with its environment."
"Sienna," Sinsky interrupted, "it's late. We need to go. But before we do, I need to clarify one more thing. You have told me repeatedly tonight that Bertrand was not an evil man, that he loved humankind, and that he simply longed so deeply to save our species that he was able to rationalize taking such drastic measures."
Sienna nodded.
"The ends justify the means," she said, quoting the notorious Florentine political theorist Machiavelli.
"So tell me," Sinsky said, "do you believe that the ends justify the means? Do you believe that Bertrand's goal to save the world was so noble that it warranted his releasing this virus?"
A tense silence settled in the room. Sienna leaned in, close to the desk, her expression forceful.
"Dr. Sinsky, as I told you, I believe Bertrand's actions were reckless and extremely dangerous. If I could have stopped him, I would have done so in a heartbeat. I need you to believe me."
Elizabeth Sinsky reached across the desk and gently grasped both of Sienna's hands in her own.
"I do believe you, Sienna. I believe every word you've told me."
Chapter 103. The pre-dawn air at Ataturk Airport was cold and laced with mist. A light fog had settled, hugging the tarmac around the private terminal. Langdon, Sienna, and Sinsky arrived by town car and were met outside by a WHO staffer who helped them out of the vehicle. "We're ready whenever you are, ma'am," the man said, ushering the trio into a modest terminal building.
"And Mr. Langdon's arrangements?" Sinsky asked.
"Private plane to Florence. His temporary travel documents are already on board." Sinsky nodded her appreciation.
"And the other matter we discussed?"
"Already in motion. The package will be shipped as soon as possible." Sinsky thanked the man, who now headed out across the tarmac toward the plane. She turned to Langdon.
"Are you sure you don't want to join us?"
She gave him a tired smile and pulled back her long silver hair, tucking it behind her ears. "Considering the situation," Langdon said playfully, "I'm not sure an art professor has much to offer."
"You've offered plenty," Sinsky said, "more than you know, not the least of which being..."
She motioned beside her to Sienna, but the young woman was no longer with them. Sienna was 20 yards back, having paused at a large window, where she was staring out at the waiting C-130, apparently deep in thought. "Thanks for trusting her," Langdon said quietly. "I sense she hasn't had a lot of that in her life."
"I suspect Sienna Brooks and I will find plenty of things to learn from each other."
Sinsky extended her palm.
"Godspeed, Professor."
"And to you," Langdon said as they shook hands. "Best of luck in Geneva."
"We'll need it," she said, and then nodded toward Sienna. "I'll give you two a moment. Just send her out when you're ready."
As Sinsky headed across the terminal, she reached absently into her pocket and pulled out the two halves of her broken amulet, clutching them tightly in one palm. "Don't give up on that rod of Asclepius," Langdon called out behind her. "It's fixable."
"Thanks," Sinsky replied with a wave. "I'm hoping everything is..."
Sienna Brooks stood alone at the window, gazing out at the lights of the runway, which looked ghostly in the low-lying fog and gathering clouds. Atop a control tower in the distance, the Turkish flag fluttered proudly, a field of red emblazoned with the ancient symbols of the crescent and star, vestiges of the Ottoman Empire still flying proudly in the modern world. "A Turkish lira for your thoughts?" a deep voice said behind her. Sienna did not turn.
"A storm is coming."
"I know," Langdon responded quietly. After a long moment, Sienna turned to him.
"And I wish you were coming to Geneva."
"Nice of you to say so," he replied. "But you'll be busy talking about the future. The last thing you need is some old-fashioned college professor slowing you down." She gave him a puzzled look.
"You think you're too old for me, don't you?"
Langdon laughed out loud. "Sienna, I am definitely too old for you." She shifted uncomfortably, feeling embarrassed.
"Okay, but at least you'll know where to find me."
She managed a girlish shrug.
"I mean, if you ever want to see me again."
He smiled at her. "I'd enjoy that." She felt her spirits lift a bit, and yet a long silence grew between them, neither of them quite certain how to say goodbye. As Sienna stared up at the American professor, she felt a surge of emotion she wasn't accustomed to feeling. Without warning, she stood on her tiptoes and kissed him full on the lips. When she pulled away, her eyes were moist with tears.
"I'll miss you," she whispered.
Langdon smiled affectionately and wrapped his arms around her. "I'll miss you, too." They stood for a long while, locked in an embrace that neither seemed willing to end. Finally, Langdon spoke. "There's an ancient saying, often attributed to Dante himself." He paused. "Remember tonight, for it's the beginning of forever."
"Thank you, Robert," she said, as the tears began to flow. "I finally feel like I have a purpose."
Langdon pulled her closer. "You always said you wanted to save the world, Sienna. This might just be your chance." Sienna smiled softly and turned away. As she walked alone toward the waiting C-130, Sienna considered everything that had happened, everything that might still happen, and all the possible futures.
"Remember tonight," she repeated to herself, "for it's the beginning of forever."
As Sienna climbed into the plane, she prayed that Dante was right. Chapter 104. The pale afternoon sun dipped low over the Piazza del Duomo, glinting off the white tiles of Giotto's bell tower and casting long shadows across Florence's magnificent cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore. The funeral for Ignazio Busoni was just getting underway as Robert Langdon slipped into the cathedral and found a seat, pleased that Ignazio's life was to be memorialized here, in the timeless basilica that he had looked after for so many years. Despite its vibrant facade, the interior of Florence's cathedral was stark, empty, and austere. Nonetheless, the ascetic sanctuary seemed to radiate an air of celebration today. From all over Italy, government officials, friends, and art world colleagues had flooded into the church to remember the jovial mountain of a man they had lovingly called Il Duomino. The media had reported that Busoni passed away while doing what he loved most, taking a late-night stroll around the Duomo. The tone of the funeral was surprisingly upbeat, with humorous commentary from friends and family, one colleague noting that Busoni's love of Renaissance art, by his own admission, had been matched only by his love of spaghetti bolognese and caramel budino. After the service, as the mourners mingled and fondly recounted incidents from Ignazio's life, Langdon wandered around the interior of the Duomo, admiring the artwork that Ignazio had so deeply loved. Vasari's Last Judgment beneath the dome, Donatello and Ghiberti's stained glass windows, Uccello's clock, and the often overlooked mosaic pavements that adorned the floor. At some point, Langdon found himself standing before a familiar face, that of Dante Alighieri, depicted in the legendary fresco by Michelino. The great poet stood before Mount Purgatory and held forth in his hands, as if in humble offering, his masterpiece, The Divine Comedy. Langdon couldn't help but wonder what Dante would have thought if he had known the effect his epic poem would have on the world centuries later, in a future even the Florentine poet himself could never have envisioned. He found eternal life, Langdon thought, recalling the early Greek philosopher's views on fame. So long as they speak your name, you shall never die. It was early evening when Langdon made his way across Piazza Santa Elisabetta and returned to Florence's elegant Hotel Brunelleschi. Upstairs in his room, he was relieved to find an oversized package waiting for him. At last, the delivery had arrived. The package I requested from Sinsky. Hurriedly, Langdon cut the tape sealing the box and lifted out the precious contents, reassured to see that it had been meticulously packed and was cushioned in bubble wrapping. To Langdon's surprise, however, the box contained some additional items. Elizabeth Sinsky, it seemed, had used her substantial influence to recover a bit more than he had requested. The box contained Langdon's own clothing, button-down shirt, khaki pants, and his frayed Harris tweed jacket, all carefully cleaned and pressed. Even his cordovan loafers were here, newly polished. Inside the box, he was also pleased to find his wallet. It was the discovery of one final item, however, that made Langdon chuckle. His reaction was part relief that the item had been returned, and part sheepishness that he cared so deeply about it. My Mickey Mouse watch. Langdon immediately fastened the collector's edition timepiece on his wrist. The feel of the worn leather band against his skin made him feel strangely secure. By the time he had gotten dressed in his own clothes and slipped his feet back into his own loafers, Robert Langdon was feeling almost like himself again. Langdon exited the hotel, carrying the delicate package with him in a Hotel Brunelleschi tote bag, which he had borrowed from the concierge. The evening was unusually warm, adding to the dreamlike quality of his walk along the Via dei Calzaiuoli, toward the lone spire of the Palazzo Vecchio. When he arrived, Langdon checked in at the security office, where his name was on a list, to see Marta Alvarez. He was directed to the Hall of the 500, which was still bustling with tourists. Langdon had arrived right on time, expecting Marta to meet him here in the entryway. But she was nowhere to be seen. He flagged down a passing docent.
"Scusi," Langdon called. "Dove posso trovare Marta Alvarez?"
The docent broke into a broad grin.
"Signora Alvarez, she no here. She have baby. Catalina, molto bella."
Langdon was pleased to hear Marta's good news.
"Ah, che bello," he replied. "Stupendo."
As the docent hurried off, Langdon wondered what he was supposed to do with the package he was carrying. Quickly making up his mind, he crossed the crowded hall of the 500, passing beneath Vasari's mural and heading up into the Palazzo Museum, staying out of sight of any security guards. Finally, he arrived outside the museum's narrow andito. The passage was dark, sealed off with stanchions, a swag, and a sign. Chiuso. Closed. Langdon took a careful glance around and then slipped under the swag and into the darkened space. He reached into his tote bag and carefully extracted the delicate package, peeling away the bubble wrapping. When the plastic fell away, Dante's death mask stared up at him once again. The fragile plaster was still in its original Ziploc bag, having been retrieved as Langdon had requested from the lockers at the Venice train station. The mask appeared to be in flawless condition, with one small exception. The addition of a poem, inscribed in an elegant spiral shape, on its reverse side. Langdon glanced at the antique display case. The Dante death mask is displayed face front. Nobody will notice. He carefully removed the mask from the Ziploc bag, then very gently he lifted it back onto the peg inside the display case. The mask sank into place, nestling against its familiar red velvet setting. Langdon closed the case and stood a moment, gazing at Dante's pale visage, a ghostly presence in the darkened room. Home at last. Before exiting the room, Langdon discreetly removed the stanchions, swag, and sign from the doorway. As he crossed the gallery, he paused to speak to a young female docent.
"Signorina," Langdon said.
"The lights above the Dante death mask need to be turned on. It's very hard to see in the dark."
"I'm sorry," the young woman said, "but that exhibit is closed. The Dante death mask is no longer here."
"That's odd." Langdon feigned a look of surprise. "I was just admiring it." The woman's face registered confusion. As she rushed off toward the Andito, Langdon quietly slipped out of the museum. Epilogue. 34,000 feet above the dark expanse of the Bay of Biscay, Alitalia's red eye to Boston cruised westward through a moonlit night. On board, Robert Langdon sat engrossed in a paperback copy of the Divine Comedy. The rhythm of the poem's lilting terza rima rhyme scheme, along with the hum of the jet engines, had lulled him into a near hypnotic state. Dante's words seemed to flow off the page, resonating in his heart, as if they had been written specifically for him in this very moment. Dante's poem, Langdon was now reminded, was not so much about the misery of hell as it was about the power of the human spirit to endure any challenge, no matter how daunting. Outside the window, a full moon had risen, dazzling and bright, blotting out all other heavenly bodies. Langdon gazed out at the expanse, lost in his thoughts of all that had transpired in the last few days. "The darkest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis." For Langdon, the meaning of these words had never felt so clear. In dangerous times, there is no sin greater than inaction. Langdon knew that he himself, like millions, was guilty of this. When it came to the circumstances of the world, denial had become a global pandemic. Langdon promised himself that he would never forget this. As the plane streaked west, Langdon thought of the two courageous women who were now in Geneva, meeting the future head-on and navigating the complexities of a changed world. Outside the window, a bank of clouds appeared on the horizon, inching slowly across the sky, finally slipping across the moon and blocking out its radiant light. Robert Langdon eased back in his seat, sensing that it was time to sleep. As he clicked off his overhead light, he turned his eyes one last time to the heavens. Outside, in the newly fallen darkness, the world had been transformed. The sky had become a glistening tapestry of stars. Inferno is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright Dan Brown, 2013. Copyright in recording, Random House Audiobooks. Dan Brown has asserted his right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988, to be identified as the author of this work.